Fireside Chat on Red Bull Music Academy Radio.
This is James Mtume. You're listening to Red Bull Music Academy Radio. I guess you would say my music is a combination of an eclectic of many different forms, most of them drawn from various aspects of black music, meaning jazz, R&B, funk, European classic, and pop. Philly. My upbringing was a little unusual for most young black kids, you know. Jimmy Heath is my biological father, obviously coming from the Heath brothers, Percy and Tootie Kumba. But the father that raised me was James Hengates Foreman. And he, too, was a great jazz musician. He was a pianist. When he was 18, he was playing with Dizzy Gillespie, Lady Day, Dinah Washington, Sonny Stitt. So, many times when those groups or those artists were in town, they would stop by for dinner, you know. So, you know, just imagine you're 9, 10 years old and you're sitting there. There's Dizzy Gillespie across there. There's Thelonious Monk, you know, Sonny Stitt, Sonny Rollins. Now, I never say I was hip enough to know just how brilliant a situation that was. But what I did know about jazz musicians were they were an extraordinary group of men and witty, funny, but they were unto themselves. It was nothing like sitting around a table of jazz musicians. Well, I always played piano, you know, because there was a piano at the house. So, you know, I had an ability to basically whatever I heard, I could kind of figure out on the piano. So I would always, you know, when I got home from school, I'd work out these little ideas and these phrases and find these chords that I'd heard on a certain record. And I guess the first time I realized that my musical palette was a little different was when I was in sixth grade and we had a music appreciation class. I don't even know if you have those anymore. We had to bring in two records, and I brought in a Frankie Lyman record, who was very popular at that time, Why Do Fools Fall in Love, and I brought in Miles Davis, the Milestone album. When the teacher put my record on, all the kids were like, you know, Frankie Lyman, yeah, yeah. And then when they put on Milestone, it was like the Grim Reaper had entered the room. Like, nobody was vibing, and I just couldn't understand it, because you know, they were both, you know, wonderful records to me, but I think that's the first time I realized that jazz was an acquired taste. Philly was such a musical town. So, you know, I'd get a chance to see all the groups that came through. But because of my jazz persuasion, when I was 14, you know, the guys used to take me to the clubs. So I'd go to the jazz clubs, you know, put on my little suit and my little hat. And, you know, they sit me in the corner just to make sure I just ordered, you know, colas. But I was also, when I was seeing Marvin Gaye, I was also seeing Cannonball. I was also seeing Herbie Hancock. I was also seeing, you know, Yusef Lateef. So I had my jazz garden had a lot of different flowers. You know, being a child of the 60s, I experienced, obviously, the entire social revolution that was happening. You know, for young black students, young white students, young Asian students, we were caught in that movement. You know, you had the Vietnam War going on. So I left school and gravitated to more political, you know, overtones in terms of what I was trying to do. And I joined an organization called US Organization that was headed by Maulana Ron Karanga. It was a black nationalist cultural organization. And we, you know, we pretty much zeroed in on things that we felt were missing. One of them that came out of that was Kwanzaa. You know, we created that some 40-something years ago. And one thing led to another, and I ended up back on the East Coast working for Imamu Baraka. And I worked on the Ken Gibson campaign, which was the first campaign to elect the first black mayor on the East Coast. And it was there that I pretty much settled in and decided, okay, I'm gonna zero in on this music. Made the decision to be a full-time musician. There were three artists that I had written down on a piece of paper in order of desire. It was Freddie Hubbard, was McCoy Tyner. Third artist was Miles Davis. Once I left the campaign, I got a call from a friend of mine and said, hey, McCoy Tyner heard about you, and he heard about you from the West Coast. He didn't know you were here. He said he wants you to come and do his album. So I'm like, okay. Check one, you know, so, but I had a great experience. You know, when I came from California, I won't say I had a little ego with me, but, you know, I was piss and vinegar. You know, I was like, yeah, I can slaughter everybody over here. And I'll never forget a guy named Mickey Roker, a drummer from Philly. And Mickey told me, I went to see him, he was playing with Lee Morgan. And he came up to me after the show, and he said, yeah, man, we've been hearing about you. We've been, you know, you're pretty much doing your thing. He said, but you'll never know how good you are until you come to New York. And I thought about it, and so I came. So we have a rehearsal the day before the session with McCoy. And there's Billy Hart, Buster Williams. I mean, you know, bad dudes. I mean, the cream of the crop. McCoy kicks off this tune. I mean, it's like, yeah, fast. So I get in, boom, 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 you know, I'm doing my thing. About 5 minutes goes by, you know. It's like, okay. I got into 10 minutes at this. I mean, I'm talking about this tempo was like you chasing a horse. And it got down there around 15 minutes, a little over 15 minutes. And I noticed for the first time in my life, I was getting cramps because it was so hard and so fast. I couldn't give up, though, you know, because I felt like I would have been a laughing stock. And fortunate for me, I think we played maybe 15 more seconds. If he played 16 more, I would have fell out, okay? He stopped just in time. So that day, my head was straight. Like, yo, man, you're nothing. You really better get it together. So I went to Billy Hart's house because he lived close to the studio, and I stayed up all night, set my drums up and put a, you know, pillow over them so I wouldn't wake up anybody. Practice all night. Fortunately, made it to the gig and made it through that day. But that was a turning point for me, you know, about what it really is and the kind of work and what it is if you want to be with the big boys, you know. ¶¶ After McCoy, I got a call from Freddie Hubbard. And it was while I was playing with Freddie at the Village Vanguard, Miles came through and came down to hear me. And the next day, I got a call. Said, you want to join the band? Like, yeah, right. Like, that's a decision, right? So we went off, and I was there with him for about 5 years. I joined Miles, and there were a couple of things that obviously shed a whole new light on how you approach music and what it was like to forge new ground. One thing that I learned about standing next to him for those years is that you can't be afraid. The one thing that people give Miles too little credit for is the courage. You know, it takes courage to change and not just accept and redo what you continue to do. That's a place where you go to die. If you don't create music that forges your imagination forward, then that's where you lay. You know, some people call it writer's block. I call it writer's blockade. I mean, you can't get out of it if you stay in it too long. And I think Miles was a master of that. Talk about a person who not only changed the entire direction of jazz, but once he started exploring electronic music, which a lot of jazz listeners were freaked out about, but a very interesting thing happened. He began to programmatically influence everything that was happening with pop music. You know, when we'd play, here's the Rolling Stones, here's Dave Matthews, you ask any hip pop or rock band, you know, they all know Miles. And why is that? They may not know Monk unless they know one or two tunes, but the fact that he forged ahead, and it took a lot of courage, because there was a lot of castigating that went down, man. You know, he ain't playing no music, this is bullshit, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I always say, acoustic and electronic, if we're talking about sound, that's a matter of preference. You know, you may like one thing and he likes another, but that should not be the determining factor of what your ear wants to digest. Because at a certain point, let's be honest, if we're going to really be honest, there's not much more to be played on those instruments that you haven't already heard. Once you go through all the greats of that time, you're going to listen to Bird, Train, Prez, Dizzy Gillespie, you know, and all these. Come on, man. What else is going to be played that you honest to God hadn't heard before? And so that was Miles' point. If you're going to create new music, you must have access to new sounds. There was a lot of technical, you know, groundbreaking that we were doing, you know. Thank you. I never wanted to sound like anybody. As a musician or as a writer or as a producer, I use other people's work as reference because you must respect, you know, the work of your contemporaries. But that's where it ended for me. I think far too often we get too, shall I say, hung up in trying to cop what someone else is doing. And that's never the joy in any art form, not just music or anything. But so I always tried to keep up with what everyone was doing. And then my challenge is always trying to find the difference in the familiar. And what I mean, if everybody's doing the same thing, like, what is your difference in that familiar? And, what, and you know, that sets you apart. I mean, why does Coltrane sound like Coltrane? You got 1,000 saxophone players. You got 1,000,000 trumpet players. How can Miles walk out and go, beep, and we go, oh, shit, you know? Because finding the difference in the familiar. And a lot of artists don't do it, and worse than that, don't know how. Our cable line means Land of the Blacks. And what I wanted to do was a mixture of some acoustic music mixed with the flavor of third world music and different instrumentation, and recorded it live, you know. So when I recorded it, I was with Miles then. We playing all this out, electronic. But I wanted to get that part of my, shall we say, my musical files and have that put away. So I wanted to do this, and I recorded it. There it is. Rebirth Cycle was after that. Again, those things basically have homage to Africa and to modal music. Yeah. I was coming from, you know, jazz, pretty much avant-garde jazz, and what we were doing, Miles. Reggie came out of commercial music. He worked with Billy Paul. So we started rooming together. And you room together, and then you find as you have certain discussions musically, okay, Reggie also had played with Ornette Coleman. I didn't know that. So it was like these things started mixing together. And I said, look, let's try to do some writing. And we tried some writing. Nothing happened. Reggie moved to Chicago, and I went back to Jersey. I get a call from Roberta Flack. You know, she was a big lover of Miles's, and she said, look, man, would you come and join my band? You know, I said, okay. So when I get there, she says, look, I need a guitar player. So I said, oh, I know a guy. So I called Reggie. I think we were in Amsterdam. I said, man, come on over here. And as it worked out, when she needed new guys in the band, she said, I need another keyboard player. I said, oh, Hubert Eaves. So I got the guys that would later become the production wing of the M2 May Lucas sound. Miles got sick, and we disbanded. And that's also when he took his 5-year hiatus. So we just started writing every day. And after I joined Roberta, I told her if she gave me an opportunity, I could get a hit. Now, of course, I'm blowing all out of my back. You know, I had no idea, but I just knew that this possibility existed. One day we were doing Blue Lights in the Basement, an album, and I was bored. And we took a dinner break. So I told the band to stay. So I gave everybody their part. I told Reggie, stay here. So I sit at the piano. Here's the melody. Reggie put the B section in. Bass player, play this. You play this. So I just wanted to put it on a cassette to listen. So as we're listening, we just laid it down and we're listening. In comes Roberta. She says, "Him too, man. What's that?" I said, "The closer I get to you, no such thing." that moment. And she said, "I love that." She said, "Can I record it?" "Yes." She said, "Do you mind if I change the key?" "No." So we laid it down right there that night. The closer I get to you, the more you make me see. She did it and played it for me, and I said, "It's cool, but I think it would be wonderful, you and Donnie again. You and Donnie Hathaway, you haven't done anything since Where's the Love?" Over and over again, I try to tell myself that we could never be more than friends, and all the while inside. And heaven's there for those who fool
special way.
The closer I get to you,
you know, long story short, called Donnie. She puts her part on, he puts his part on, and the rest was history. And we do the next song, which was Back Together Again. And as we're working on that song, Donnie and I'm, you know, he's at the mic, I'm back here, and he grabs his eye. He couldn't sing anymore because Donnie was suffering from a nervous, you know, condition. And it was a Saturday night, and I said, well, look, I'll see you Monday, we'll finish this. And he said, yeah. About 5 o'clock in the morning, the phone rang, and I hear this crying. I asked, well, who's this? He said, it's Roberta. I said, well, what's happening? She said, Donnie's dead. He jumped that night. So, you know, for me, that song will always, you know, possess, you know, I've been fortunate enough to write a lot of songs, but that one has a place that none of the others could. The Mtume Band, we have to look at it in two phases. The first phase, which was represented by Kiss This World Goodbye, was pretty much the Roberta Flack backup band, okay? I was in it, Cezar, Basil Farrington, Howard King, Harry Whitaker, Hubert Eaves, and Reggie Lucas. That's when I was beginning to utilize that band, because in my mind, okay, I want to produce, and so we would work out these little grooves, little funk grooves. I mean, you're playing with Roberta Flack. I mean, Killing Me Softly, you know, big orchestra, and so she would let us close the show. So I would say, okay, so I would start jumping out from behind the drums. And I go out front, you know, all right, everybody get up, you know, doing it. And he's, you know, it's great. You see these stuffy, you know, people get up and they're like, and they're funking. So she let that go. And then one day she came and she says, you know what? When we get back to New York, I can get you a deal. You know, guy assigned to me, and I'll get you a deal at Atlantic. Whoa. Of course, that never happened. So we were in Denver, and by this time, we're getting real tight. The Closer I Get to You had come out. So the audience was changing. You're getting mostly black people now. You know, The Closer, right? So when I started closing, one way, we were in Chicago. I was closing up. You know, y'all get on up. And we were boom, boom, back to boom. She comes running down the steps and runs out and grabs the microphone to try to pull it from me. And I'm like, what the f-? So I let her have it. And she's trying to do that. So the next morning, she calls a band meeting. She said, you guys may think you're Parliament Funkadelic, but you're not. And I said, okay, this is getting weird. I haven't got the record date we wanted. Now we're being demeaned. So at the end of that meeting, I said, well, I'm out. After we finish this leg of the tour, I'm leaving. Much to my chagrin, everybody else said, yeah, you know, we leaving too. I hadn't talked to anybody because I just had that emotion, that moment. So I leave the room. My mind is all messed up. Oh, my God. I don't have no work for these guys. I don't have no work for me. And again, tying back to how things work out, that's when the call came through for Stephanie Mills. Phyllis Hyman was another great artist, as well as a great personality. By that I mean Phyllis was an artist who, if you weren't strong, she'd walk all over you. Okay, I remember the first day she came. There was an entourage, and I told everybody they had to leave, you know, because I don't work like that. When you're doing vocals, if you got people in the studio, an artist can't help but perform. You see, so to take that out, just the artist, producer, engineer. So it's just me and the engineer. So that was the first time she cussed me out. Then after the session, she said, oh, you know what I'm doing, man? I see what you mean. Okay, yeah. There was one part on the You Know How to Love Me. The next time you listen to that record, where she says this line, there's no denying. Holds it long. I make her hold it. At the end of that, she says, is that it, motherfucker? Because that was about the 13th or 14th days. I said, no, I want it right. So she storms out. I said, everybody take dinner break. So we go to dinner break. I have the guy working at the studio. I said, get a dozen roses. Come back. Ties it around her microphone in the studio. She comes in, sees it, breaks down crying. That's the kind of person she was, man. Just, you know, you can't sing like that and not have heart, you know. But Phyllis was No one sounds like her, that's for sure.
Red Bull Music Academy Radio, keep it locked.
Of the M2MA band is interesting. You have to remember, we as M2MA Lucas, most of the cats were also the production band. You know, so they were, so we doing like 10, 11 projects a year. You know, everybody's working. And I gotten to the point where I remember the moment I sat down at the piano and tears started coming down my eyes. And I didn't know what it was or why it was. And that's when I realized one thing: I had never lied to the music, and the music had never lied to me, and that I was playing something that sounded just like something else I had done. And I got up and I walked away and I disbanded the band, and I decided not to do any more productions. And I went to another studio, found a studio, booked it for a year, and just worked. I had to work to find out where I was going, and then I had to work to put a band together. You know, it was truly a work in progress, a new style, because I believe studio is your extra musician, because that's the sound, you know, that's the ambiance. So I found a studio and then began to put the second phase of the M2MA band together that would ultimately be the Juicy Fruit. the juicy fruit, what I got to ultimately was what I called neo-minimalism, where I was experimenting with how to take Lease and make it sound more, and placement of instruments, and orchestration of even the drums. So if you listen to something like Juicy Fruit, it may sound like something big, but it's only maybe four or five instruments played. And that was a whole new thing. And also no reverb or nothing. So it sounded like, you know, you could have played it in your basement, you know. And when I took it to the record company, they didn't want to release it, because at that time, everybody was talking about beats per minute, you know, and they said, no one will like this because it's 83 beats per whatever that stupid stuff was. And I told them I didn't write from my head, I wrote from my heart. And I said, none of y'all buy records anyway, so let's see what the people say. To smack me in my face, which I felt was a smack, given all that I had done in the music business, they refused to release Juicy Fruit for daytime radio. They released it for nighttime radio after 12 o'clock. And much to their surprise, after the first week, they were getting calls from every radio station around the country. They wanted it for daytime. Yeah. I get a call from Wrigley's Gum. Mr. Mtume, we'd like to, you know, want to take a deposition. So I didn't even take a lawyer with me because I knew where it was going. So they go in. Man, this is the biggest fucking room I'd ever been in my life, man. 60, 70 lawyers. Yeah. So I sit down. They've got the album blown up all over the place. They were trying to find a way to connect that with the Gum. So here's one of the highlights of my life. I can be in sleep and wake up and laugh. So they go through all this and they bang, oh, does anything have to do with going? I said, no. So finally one of the guys says, well, would you mind telling us what the phrase is? What do you mean by the phrase, you can lick me everywhere? I said, well, very simply, it's about oral sex. You want to see a bunch of guys turn red? I said, it's oral sex. And I'm saying, you can lick me everywhere. I said, I don't know about you, but I don't think of Gum. So, enough said. Okay, all right, okay, this is over. And, you know, that's where that went. I'm always surprised at how Juicy has spanned generations, you know. I mean, obviously with Biggie. I dug it. They actually wanted me to be in it. I laughed. I said, no, you ain't doing that, man. What, you want me to jump around the corner in some high shoes and plaid pants? Juicy, you know. So they fell out laughing. No, I said, each generation, y'all do what you do. I write music for people, and if they feel it and they dig it, my job is done.
Call out his name.
I first became aware that the hip-hop community was aware of the Native Son soundtrack because Grandmaster Flash called me, and he came over to the house. He wanted to know if he could, you know, get okay to use the Biggest Beat thing. I don't think he ever used it, but we had a very interesting conversation after, and he was saying, man, you know, Toombs, he said, the thing that we love about your music, talking about the younger cats, he said, your music is holy. And he said, I don't mean no religious. He said, it's holy. He said, there's so much space. And that's why we can snatch pieces of this. And then the next thing I knew, you know, it was being sampled by some of the younger hip-hop cats. I was on the radio. There's a thing we used to do on Kiss FM called Year in Review. We were talking about what, you know, what we thought was a drag and what we thought was hip. On that same show, we were talking about sampling. And I said, if you're going to sample somebody, you need to pay him. I said, it's just like if I sampled a rapper and just took him and put it on one of my songs, does that make it my song? No. I said, it's a combination, you know? And so they heard what they wanted to hear, that I was dogging sampling. So they went in and made this record called Talk and All That Jazz. It just went to war after that, you know? And I couldn't get any, you know what it was like? I was like the only cat from my generation talking that. Everybody else was just glad to be sampled, even though they weren't given anything. You know, yeah, I got sampled. I thought, like, yeah, I took a piss. What are you happy about? You know, and it turned into a whole thing. And in retrospect, you know, I got a little hard because, you know, when you're out there by yourself, I always tell people, I'm not scared of being on a limb. I'm just scared of sauce, you know. So, but nobody's saying nothing. And finally, we worked it out when I ran into, a few years later, Daddy-O came up to me. I said, man, I see what you mean. Because the younger guys, he was trying to learn how to play keyboards. And he said, man, the younger guys is telling me I ain't doing nothing. So that's just a generational thing. But I think it did help bring attention to that because I think it had gone real crazy. I mean, James Brown, she could have owned New York. You know, I mean, they'd sample everything, just sample. But they wouldn't do that to the white artists, because the minute they did that, I remember De La Soul on that album. They did Opaque, you know, and that they had to stop that album and a few other things. It's just that a lot of the older R&B guys just laid down, and it wasn't right. I always felt sampling was a pit stop, because I do know everything was taken out of the schools. I mean, where could a kid learn how to play, you know? But you were never supposed to live there. You know what I mean? The whole thing about music, man, is how do you expand the dimensions, you know, of the possibilities? All art is just a combination of art and technology. I mean, I always say this. When the 440 temper scale piano came out, I'm sure there was some harpsichord players saying, them motherfuckers ain't keeping it real. You know what I mean? It's just like, it's just how it is. It's the evolution. That's the evolution, yeah, sure. I mean, the earth wasn't born with a saxophone somewhere. It was created, you know, technology. You did The Native Son and then The New York Undercover. It was about 4 or 5 years or whatever it was. And, you know, you got to know when to leave before your audience does, you know. And retired, I don't know. You know, I'd have to hear something that excited my imagination. Or if my music has inspired anybody, the thing I would want them to be inspired to do is pick up the baton, because this race is not finished. You know, all you need is to have your imagination excited.
Stop.